WFAE streaming is funded by Garage Door Guru, providing local comprehensive garage door service for over 12 years, including detailed repairs and door installations, offering fine German-made garage doors. Details, go garagedoorguru.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. I suppose there are some people out there who believe in ghosts, those supernatural specters that haunt the night. But most of us know that ghosts aren't real. Well, this may be another example where the majority is in the wrong, because according to at least one of our guests of this hour, ghosts are real, but not for the reasons you think. Being this close to Halloween, we thought now would be the right time to introduce the scientific evidence for ghosts and spend some time talking about how ghosts have more traditionally made their presence known through film. Mark Pisano is a professor of theater and film at UNC Charlotte, but his writings include a book called Ghosts of Theater and Cinema in the Brain. He's the one who says ghosts are real because we create them all the time. And we'll get into that with him this hour. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mike.
Welcome back, I should say. Yeah. We're also going to get into the topic of ghosts in our film culture. Mark can also talk about that, as can our other guest, Matt Brunson, the longtime film critic with Creative Loafing, the entertainment editor there. Good to have you back without the other critics cramping your style, Matt.
Sounds good to me.
Although Matt joins us by phone because he's afraid of ghosts, and we're doing this show at Spirit Square. So,
actually, I'm there in the studio, but I'm just kind of in a ghostly form, so you can't really see me.
Well, that's one of Mark's theories, as a matter of fact, which we'll get into. Let's start with the obvious question, Mark. What do you mean by ghosts being real because we create them every day?
Well, I'd like to put aside the question of whether ghosts are immortal beings. Either our souls continue after death or souls returning to the world through repeated life cycles, and just look at our experience of ghosts and how they manifest in our imaginations and in sometimes when people actually meet a ghost, a sense a spiritual presence, but also how they appear in theater and film. Mm-hmm. So there are traces of the people that influence us inside our brains through our memories and through emotional contagion and how personalities, especially those close to us, influence us. And after those people die, or after we die, hopefully, we continue to influence others or they influence us through those traces. So that's the good news, that we do have an afterlife in that material sense. Maybe the bad news is that we don't have much control over that. So my influence on you or yours on me, and you have a great influence through the radio on other people. But people who haven't ever seen you might imagine you differently from how you actually would appear in real life.
Rock Hudson.
Exactly.
In their imagination.
Right. Yeah. So there's lots of fictionalizing of that we do of one another. Mm-hmm. And in a sense, we're ghosting one another or creating the ghosts of each other in our heads.
Well, we create our own ghosts of ourselves, you say, that we are ourselves ghosts in our own minds, that we exist as phantom images and ideas of self. And if I understand you correctly, because it was really hard to understand your book.
Okay, sorry.
Because it was in all this neural stuff. Yeah. The mind, the way the mind constructs these phantom images, the very fact that it does, has set the stage for ghosts in theater and film. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, exactly. So there's what I call an inner theater inside our heads and an inner cinema. So the title of my book is actually a kind of doubling, ghosting of itself. Ghosts of Theater and Cinema is what it's about. But it's also about theater and cinema in the brain. So it's called Ghosts of Theater and Cinema in the
Brain. How do you make the leap from what's happening in your brain and the possibility of real ghosts or not real ghosts or ghosts as you describe them as being traces of neural traces in the brain? Right. How do you make the leap from that into film or into theater or into any storytelling where ghosts are involved?
Well, cinema is a very ghostly medium, and it carries on a tradition of theater, but in a way that is more spectral because it's just the projection of images on a screen.
I'm hearing Gloria Swanson in my head. People out there in the dark.
There you go. There's a tradition of especially those kind of horror, ghostly presence melodramas. In fact, there's a one that was a huge hit on the London stage and then in New York, and then made into a movie recently called Women in Black, which went back to that tradition of melodrama on stage. Mm-hmm. And in my book, I actually trace it all the way back to the ancient Greek drama. So I think humans, at least as far back as that, probably even farther back, have told stories and then acted out stories where we can at least imagine or extend the ghostly presences inside our brains to a shared experience, like dreaming collectively.
Matt, I don't know how many films deal specifically with ghosts or things like ghosts, apparitions, whatever. But there are a considerable number of them, and I'm curious as to whether or not you have a theory as to why we have this fascination with ghosts in film and other entertainment forms.
I think it's the same fascination we have with the horror film in general. It's something slightly different, something spooky, something that we don't see in everyday life, a leap of the fantastic. I really like his theory. I think that's more plausible than your usual, you know, just straightforward ghost theory, which, you know, to me can sometimes border on the Loch Ness Monster type stuff, or, you know, aliens visiting farmland, you know, yahoos. But yes, there's been a long tradition of ghost stories in movies that dates back all the way to the, you know, late 19th century, actually, with Georges Méliès, who was recently immortalized again on screen in the movie Hugo by Martin Scorsese. He was one of the first practitioners of cinema and also the first person to really delve into special effects. So naturally, his types of movies would lend themselves to being able to tinker around with supernatural, fantastic elements. So he himself made a few ghost stories, and from then on, we've had our fair share of them over the years.
There are a lot of films about a lot of supernatural forms, from vampires to zombies to ghosts and other things. I would think most vampire, not all, but the vast majority of vampire and zombie films are in that horror genre. But not all ghost films are in that horror genre. Some of them are comedies.
Right.
Why? Why don't vampires and zombies lend themselves to comedy? And there have been some examples of that, but why not?
I think, well, there have been, like you say, a George Hamilton Love at First Bite, you know, right. Children right. of the Night, shut up. I think, I don't know, I guess with the ghosts, it's not as rooted in the traditional, like, the monsters you see is what you get. I think there's more opportunities for comedy. I mean, one of the best titles of a ghost movie is The Ghost in the Invisible Bikini, which was the last of those beach party movies. So any movie with a title like that, you're not going to take very seriously.
But you're going to go see it to see what the invisible bikini reveals.
I would add to that, Mike, that there's different types of ghosts, which is kind of interesting. There's the mournful ghost that's still attached to people and things in the world and can't go on to some other place. And that, you know, can be also turned into a romantic comedy, like the movie called Ghost,
yeah. You
know, with Patrick Swayze. So that kind of dark or horror ghost, which appears in The Ring, for example, which is a remake of The Ringu, a Japanese film, and it's one of the films in our series, which I hope we'll talk about too, because that's going to be shown here in Charlotte, and we're going to have a discussion afterwards. That kind of horror ghost that's attached to people or that are haunting people and things because it's very sad or grieving, or then that relates to another type of ghost too, the vengeful ghost, so one that is more vicious. That is more on the spectrum, if you like, of the dark ghost, whereas the mournful ghost can be over on the side of one that can be reconnected with in a loving way, but just as too weak or masochistic sometimes too, suffering and enjoying its suffering. There's an interesting book by Catherine Folks called Giving Up the Ghost, where she looks at romantic comedy ghosts in that way. Mm.
What's your personal interest in this? What drove you to do all this research and write this book and put together this Spirits Rise, a ghost film series that's coming to town?
Right.
Well, it's actually here already.
Yeah. It started last Saturday with The Innocents, and we're going to have The Hamlet made in 2000, this Saturday at 2 o'clock in Imagineon, and I'll be leading a discussion after the screening at 2 o'clock. And then we'll have...
We'll talk about all these
We'll go through that list later.
Laundry list now, what's your personal interest?
My personal interest, I'll be honest with you, since it's just the two of us and Matt. And I mentioned this in my book, that my mother died when I was a child, and my aunt, her older sister, experienced a vision of her. And it was a very positive thing. And so I wondered, as a child and much later, why I never saw my mother like that, but also, you know, how ghosts can be positive sometimes in comic films, and why ghosts are often more threatening, but also how it could be a real experience for some people, not a matter of being crazy. So about 10 years ago, I started to investigate, using psychoanalytic theory, but also current neuroscience, how this could be possible. And a very interesting book that I'd highly recommend, which kind of got me started on this, by a neurologist and a science writer. V.S. Ramachandran is the neurologist. Sandra Blakesley is the science writer. It's called Phantoms in the Brain. And one of the things related to what we've already been talking about is the notion, actually a discovery by Ramachandran as a neuroscientist, neurologist, treating patients with amputations. They had, this has been long been known, what's called phantom limb syndrome, where they experience sensations in the missing limb, leg or arm. And but he found a way to cure this by setting up a mirror so that the patient would see their remaining limb in the mirror reflected as if the phantom limb had a presence then, had an actual image. And then they could manipulate that phantom by moving the hand or arm of the hand that, that they still had that was reflected in the mirror and looked like then that their missing limb was being manipulated by them. And so that was sending signals to the kind of frozen area, the stuck area, the amputated area that was not receiving feedback to the brain. And so Ramachandran's theory is that because of the amputation, the brain is was calling on stored pain messages with what was missing there because it wasn't getting feedback. So by seeing the image again in the mirror and getting feedback, the person was able to remind the brain or get the brain unstuck from that feedback loop. So seeing a presence of a loved one, like an extension of oneself, maybe a a way to help cure the mournful missing pain of that amputation of an extended self. And exploring this helped me realize how much we're interconnected, how much we don't exist as separate bodies or beings. We're very much our identity is through the other.
But of course, you are a professor of theater and film, and you say that ghosts have been explored in these media for, well, since the beginning of them, the beginning of theater. Theater you describe as the more mortal of the performing arts because we can only show what the person is going through at the moment in at this time on this plane, whereas in movies, you can take liberties with time. You can speed things up. You can do montages. You can segment things. You can splice them. Has that led, has cinema led to a greater use of ghosts in storytelling? Because you can do so many things.
I think so. I mean, the media of theater and cinema are very different in some respects. And the audience is put in a kind of ghostly position when you're in a movie theater or even watching it on DVD. Then you're able to float through space and jump in time as a kind of ghostly presence to the characters on screen.
Plus the camera is like a ghost because it's eavesdropping on things invisibly. The characters don't know in most cases that the camera is there unless you're watching The Office. Dr. Mark Pizzato and Matt Brunson with us. We're going to talk about ghosts in movies some more and talk about some specific films when we come back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Frenzel Properties, a full-service residential real estate brokerage firm leading clients to today's complex Charlotte real estate market. Frenzel Properties now at 2100 Crescent Avenue in Eastover and frenzelproperties.com. And Charlotte Concerts presenting the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center. Chamber music players today, 8 p.m. at Halton Theater, charlotteconcerts.org. I want to tell you something pretty shocking. the Constitution does not include your right to vote. And that's just the start of what some people call America's crazy quilt of local, state, and federal election systems. There's so many rules, so many regulations, and mistakes in our system. It's a wonder we've made it this far down the road. And we're going to talk about all this, electoral dysfunction issues, tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, thousands have been exposed to deadly fungal meningitis from tainted steroid injections, what the outbreak reveals about regulations and oversight of compounding pharmacies, and the risk to public health.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon right after Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, your NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about ghosts in the real world and on film, in television, theater. Dr. Mark Pezzato is professor of theater and film at UNC Charlotte, author of Ghosts of Theater and Cinema in the Brain. Matt Brunson is the entertainment editor and movie critic for Creative Loafing. And there's a film series about all this, Spirits Rise, a ghost film series underway at UNC Charlotte, and a combination effort of UNC Charlotte and the Charlotte Mecklenburg Public Library at Imagineon and the UN City the UNC Charlotte Center City campus, right, through November the 17th. We'll get into some specific films in that series and other films that Matt wants to bring up and that you want to bring up as we go to this conversation. I touched on something a second ago that you said that films lend themselves more to, I think this is what you said, to spirits and to ghosts, perhaps than theater, for a number of reasons. But film allows the viewer to have an out-of-body experience, that we've always been, you say, imaginary constituted entities anyway, but that film allows us to be like a ghost flying through space and time in the various camera angles, tracking shots, quick cuts, and flashbacks. I understand that last part of it, being the unseen observer, seeing things from every angle as a result of watching a movie unfold, but we've always been imaginary constituted entities. How so?
Well, this is where neuroscience helps us to understand that there's no one integral area for self in the brain. So we actually have multiple cells or neural circuits that shift in our sense of self throughout moment-to-moment experience. So Ramachandran, in that book I mentioned, Phantoms in the Brain, lists and explains a number of different cells that we have, the embodied self, the passionate self, the visceral, the executive, the vigilant, the mnemonic, which is the memory, the autobiographical self. And he explains which brain areas are involved, how different brain areas are involved. And so we create the illusion of self, which he points out is integrally involved with the vigilant self and free will and the anterior cingulate gyrus, if you want a anatomical term. But that actually involves the limbic system, which many people have heard about. It's the emotional core of the brain around the thalamus and the brainstem, which are, you know, the deeper parts of the brain that go down to your spinal cord, and between that and the neocortex, which is the top layer of the brain. And by the way, I want to mention that David Basher, who's a biology emeritus professor at UNC Charlotte, has met with me over the last, I think, 6-7 years since I published this book, almost weekly, to help me understand the neuroscience. So I really appreciate his help, because I've been able to, you know, write another book, and I'm working on yet another now that involves neuroscience, theater, and cinema. But he's really helped me to understand the finer details of this, too.
Why does this help? I want to get back to Matt in a second here, but why does understanding neuroscience help you understand how theater works or how it could work or how film works or how it could work?
Right. So it's that relationship between the inner theater and cinema that we experience with our eyes closed or when we're dreaming, and also when we're representing reality, when we experience what we think is reality, it's actually a construction inside of our brains. And understanding the neuroanatomy a little bit helps us to understand the evolutionary heritage to that, and also the way that there are different components to it, which there's more and more research now on what's called simulation theory, or how we're simulating one another all the time, through a recent discovery about 20 years ago of mirror neurons, mm-hmm. so that we're actually at a subconscious level simulating each other's emotions and motor actions, physical actions. And so that's why cinema and theater are so important to us. It's a way that we can become more aware of how what's going on all the time in the theater of everyday life, this kind of simulating of one another in what I call the backstage people in our brains, if there's a theater in our brains, that metaphor, signaling to one another without our really being aware of it.
Matt, I know that you were planning on talking about specific films, but I'm with regard to Ghosts, but I'm just curious if you've ever thought about films allowing us to be like a ghost flying through space and time through camera angles and tracking shots and things like that.
I never think of it in ghostly terms, although that of course makes sense. More of an omniscient presence, of course, you know, that you're there with the people, you're looking at it from all sorts of angles, even overhead. You know, I love that great shot in Psycho where Martin Balsam gets killed at the top of the stairs because you're overhead. You're like either God or Alfred Hitchcock looking down. So, of course, that could extend also to being a ghostly spiritual presence overseeing the proceedings going on.
You know, we talked in the last segment about the various kinds of ghosts. Some are friendly, most are not. some are malicious and mean as harm. Some are stuck here and want to go on, but they just can't seem to get unstuck. And as you say in the book, there are two primary modes of ghosts in film: the impotent, demanding, abject figure with unfinished business, or the potent, mischievous, godlike trickster. How did these become stock characters?
Well, I think, again, they're manifesting something within us and between us, right? So we have a sense ourselves of being impotent sometimes, or of, especially as we become aware of our mortality, having a kind of helplessness, and yet a hope that, you know, aspirations that will live on, and some of us believe that we actually have a soul that might live on. And so then that spurs our imagination and our dreams, mm-hmm. of having that experience ourselves, or of meeting a spirit that has lived on, or even someone close to us who might. And then we also have a trickster side to ourselves, right? Or these agents or mechanisms within our brains that operate without our being even aware of it. In fact, you mentioned zombies before, and Ramachandran and Blakeslee talk about in that book, Phantoms in the Brain, zombies within us, in it, as a way to explain these other selves operating the level below consciousness.
Do those two stock characters sum it up for you, Matt, or are there other examples of other kinds of ghosts in movies that you can think of?
Two sounds kind of limiting. I'm sure it's explained more in detail. Because you said the trickster, but then you didn't necessarily say the revenge-seeking ghost or the evil ghost. Would they all fall under that category?
Yeah, I would say that the vengeful ghost can be either on the more mournful side or on the trickster and malicious side. And in fact, we're going to talk about Hamlet. We're going to see a screening of Hamlet this Saturday at 2 o'clock at Imagineon in the Wells Fargo Theater, which is updated. It's, of course, Shakespeare's play, but updated to the year 2000, directed by Michael Almereyda. And we have Ethan Hawke as Hamlet and Sam Shepard as his father appearing to him. But he appears first on the CCTV, the security monitors, in a New York City, Manhattan high-rise. And so the security guard and others see him first and see him in the hall, lurking in the hallways, in the kind of movie tradition of a translucent ghost, right? So it's kind of seems kind of weak because it's fading in and out. So this ghost first appears as a haunting presence and fades into a Pepsi One machine in the hallway of the high-rise. And then it turns out that this is also the CEO, he was the former CEO of the Denmark Corporation, and that now the new CEO, Claudius, has taken over and married the former mother, the former wife of Hamlet's father, and his mother, Gertrude. And so Hamlet is distressed by all this, and he's using his own taking of videos and videos he's taken of his father and mother together to remember them first, and then and express his mournfulness. But then he's also confronted with this ghostly presence who becomes palpably material then and even grabs him physically. So you have both sides of the mournful, somewhat impotent ghost who's just haunting and fading through the hallway, and then the ghost that becomes more vengeful as a trickster.
We all know that Hamlet's father appears as a ghost in the play and therefore in this film. But Matt, had you thought of Hamlet in any form on film being a ghost movie?
Well, certainly it falls under a subgenre of that. That's
because
it's kind of a minor role,
this particular game.
Yes, but like it would definitely fall under, like, if you had the keywords for it, a ghost story would not be out of reach for that.
Well, he kind of motivates the entire play, too. In fact, Shakespeare probably played the role himself.
You think?
Yeah. Because that's what scholars say.
Okay. Why did you choose this for the film series?
I chose it because I wrote an entire chapter on various Hamlet films in my book. And this one was the most recent one that I explored and the one that, to me, was the most interesting as changing the film in ways that I thought were really intriguing and very appropriate to connect it to life today and coincidentally appeared 1 year before 9/11 in this high rise with Denmark becoming this corporation. So it connects current life, a young slacker, Ethan Hawke playing Hamlet, the use of media in the film relates to some things we've been talking about, cinema as a ghostly medium, and also what happened then a year later at 9/11.
I want to get back to these types of ghosts for a second. You say that these two types of ghosts, the impotent, demanding, abject figure with unfinished business and the potent, mischievous, godlike trickster, that they, along with their zombie and vampire cousins, point to the death and erotic drives within the human brain.
Mm-hmm.
I understand the erotic part of the vampire situation. Mm-hmm. All you have to do is watch True Blood to get that.
Right.
But zombies and ghosts have an erotic drive?
Sure.
Who knew?
Yeah. Well, that's the terminology, of course, comes from Freud.
Uh-huh.
But I relate it to evolution as well, that according to Darwin, we've got these primal drives in us as animals to reproduce and to survive. So the death drive in us is actually the life and death drive. It's this survival instinct. And, of course, the sexual selection becomes very important in how our genes are carried on. But ghosts are very important in this, too, because they're the extension of this mortality and yet hope for transcendence, and then how there's a kind of force of nature that moves through us as a spiritual force, too.
In Ghost, the Patrick Swayze film, obviously there is this, if I recall this correctly, Matt, there is this moment in the film, maybe several moments in the film, where Patrick Swayze, the ghost, comes back and embraces, is it Demi Moore? Is that who does it?
Yeah.
Embraces her, or she feels that he's embracing her. Give me some other examples of this.
And I think it's through Whoopi Goldberg, too.
Yeah, okay. Oh, that's right.
Yeah, it is through Whoopi Goldberg. But, yeah, I could definitely see it with the ghost stories. I mean, because The Sixth Sense, the whole thing, well, I don't want to give away the ending for the two people who haven't seen it, but the whole thing is, you know, because of his love for his wife. There's always a lot of romantic elements in that. I have to admit, zombies is a bit of a stretch for me, but I can understand. I just rewatched Shaun of the Dead lately, and really that's a movie about family and sticking together even when your relatives are decomposing. So I guess it makes sense there, too.
Really? So, I'm just, why do filmmakers make these movies about ghosts? What's their drive, and what is our drive to see them?
I think some of it is just to make money out of scaring people.
Okay.
Right? For entertainment.
An honest man appears on the program.
But I'm picking to write about, and I hope we've picked in the film series, films that are more complex. So they're actually also have an artistic dimension or a tragic comic dimension where you just don't have evil ghosts or ghosts that, you know, you fall in love with, but ghosts that are both good and evil or express that those forces in us. And so, for example, we're also doing on October 27th at 2 p.m., this time in the Center City building, with a discussion afterwards led by myself, The Others, which is a film from 2001 by Alejandro Amenábar, a Spanish director, but it stars Nicole Kidman. And it's like The Sixth Sense that Matt mentioned. It involves ghosts that are kind of between worlds and haunting one another within a haunted house. And so it explores how that can happen to any of us if we're in a house, especially a place we've lived in that has a lot of memories, how we're in a sense haunted by the presences of who has been in the house, maybe that we've lost or, you know, is no longer there, and things that we feel connected to those people.
Hmm. You know this film, Matt, I take it?
Oh, I love this film. I think it's much better than The Sixth Sense, largely because in addition to the, you know, gotcha twist, this movie just has an incredible atmosphere throughout, and Nicole Kidman's performance in it is exceptional. This is definitely one of my favorite ghost movies.
Wow. Actually, you're doing two films. If I'm not mistaken, the other has its basis in the James Joyce novel Turn of the Screw. Is that right?
No, actually, no? That was The Innocents.
Okay.
Others does too, and to some extent. That's true, yeah.
Okay. So the Innocents, talk about that. Is that the one that's already been on?
We did that last Saturday, but you can rent it.
Anyway.
It's from 1961. And by the way, I want to mention Sam Shapiro led the discussion of that one. He'll also lead a discussion coming up November 10th of The Ring. And he helped organize.
Let's talk about The Innocents first.
Yeah, he helped to organize this festival with me, along with Meg Whalen, director of communications for the College of Arts and Architecture at UNC Charlotte. But the Innocents is, as you said, based on Turn of the Screw, and it kind of shows, especially in an interesting way, when the film was made in the 1960s, the potential perversity of children or children who may be possessed by perverse adult ghosts in the situation of Victorian England.
We love this theme, Matt. The potential perversity of children seems to show up a lot in contemporary film, doesn't it?
Yeah.
What? Yes. Good. Thank you. Thank you, Matt. Thanks for joining me. why do you suppose that is?
Oh, me?
You, yes.
I guess, I don't know, they're supposed to be the most innocent things around, but, you know, they're really, I don't know, vicious little creatures sometimes. I don't know, I think that it has a lot to do with that we see this as one of the last thresholds of goodness and such, and it's one of the complete reversals of audience expectations when you have children be the source of something malevolent, something evil, not just in ghost stories, but in other movies like Village of the Damned, you know.
Damien.
And Damien, you know, which had him come from out of space, and then Damien with the supernatural element.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I think it's also, Mike, that there's a child still within each of us, right? And we were children at some point. And as children, we might have had imaginary friends, many kids do, or we had fantasy lives that were perhaps richer or at least less channeled, you know, than they have become. And so we can reconnect with the innocence of childhood, but also remember some of the more perverse desires or at least rebellious instincts that we have.
And these fantasies that we've had as children, I suppose, and even as adults, because some of us engage in fantasy as an adult, are kind of ghost lives, aren't they?
Yeah, I think so. And you asked before why we make ghost films, and I think a lot of it has to do with, as I said, collective dreaming, and there's a theory about dreams that it might be threat rehearsals. So that's something that could be a way that we protect ourselves from ghosts.
We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Carolina Clay Matters Pottery Guild, presenting the works of more than 45 clay artists at the McAlpine Business Park Saturday, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Details at carolinaclaymatters.org. And the Avio Group, a consulting firm offering a comprehensive approach to business improvement by focusing on project and change management, online at wemanagechange.com. Political stakes are high in a number of House and Senate races across the country, so today on the Diane Rehm Show, a look at the key contests to watch and how the outcomes could shape the new Congress. That's coming up in 20 minutes at 10. You want to talk about ghosts? Ghosts in movies? 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE, or online, wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back. Ooh.
Hello, it's Garrison Keillor reminding you that A Prairie Home Companion is heard at 6 o'clock on Saturday, 12 noon on Sunday, right here on 90.7 WFAE. Hope you'll join us for music and comedy and, of course, the news from Lake Wobegon. Saturdays at 6, Sundays at noon on listener-supported WFAE Charlotte's NPR News station.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about ghosts in movies and in life because we create them every day, according to Dr. Mark Pizzotto. Our guest is a professor of theater and film at UNC Charlotte, author of Ghosts of Theater and Cinema in the Brain, in which he delves into not just this film criticism poppycock, but neuroscience, because you've done a lot of research with some fellow people at UNC Charlotte's help. Matt Brunson's on the phone with us. He's the entertainment editor and movie critic for Creative Loafing. I'm going to ask you to list a bunch of your favorite ghost films in a second here, Matt, and maybe you'd like to chime in too as you're listening at 704-926-WFAE, 800-603-WFAE, or email us, Facebook us, etc., wfae.org/charlottetalks. This is conversations being conducted because of the Spirits Rise Ghost Film series, which goes through November 17th at Imaginon and UNC Charlotte Center City. One of the other films in this series is The Ring. It's an American remake of a Japanese film, and it deals with a vengeful female ghost who strikes at victims through a video cassette left in a rental cabin in the woods. That seems like a stretch to me, but fill us in, both of you.
Well, I would say that it's really interesting if you see both films. We'll just be screening the American version of The Ring with Sam Shapiro leading this discussion afterwards. But hopefully some people will, either before they see that on November 10th, and join in the discussion after the film at the Center City building of UNC Charlotte. We'll see Ringu, the Japanese version, before or after that, so they can compare them. I led a class on female ghosts at UNC Charlotte last spring. It was really interesting to talk with the young students about what ghosts mean to them, especially these kind of female ones that are appearing. And in Asian films often, in fact, there's another one that one of the students presented in class called Shudder from Thailand, which is really interesting too. Yeah. The ghosts often just appear and haunt people for apparently no reason, or it's very mysterious as to why. And so I think that perhaps comes from the Asian tradition of animism that's stronger there, at least, than here in European-American culture. So that sense that there are spirits in everything. And in certain places, there might be vengeful spirits or negative spirits, but it's very mysterious as to why that force is haunting and rather happenstance that people just encounter them. And this has been transferred in an interesting way with Ringu. It was first a novel and then a Japanese film. And the American version extends that to give us more of the backstory. So it actually fills out the story as to why the ghost would be attached to the video cassette and attached to a well.
Have you seen this film, Matt?
Yes, I have.
And? Put your critic hat on.
I think in a lot of the cases of the American remake, the foreign language horror films, especially Japanese ones, I think a lot gets lost in the translation, or at least a lot of the potency. So I think movies like The Ring and The Grudge, They're enjoyable watches, but I actually prefer the originals.
You are a purist, aren't you? let's take a phone call from Tom in York. Welcome to the program, Tom.
Good morning. I'd like to ask the gentleman what, in their study of psychology, what they think would happen if children were taught that certain things in their imagination were real. Would they then, later in life, be able to vision these supernatural fantasies as being real?
I would say that that has a great deal to do with it, how our imagination is shaped in childhood. In fact, one of the phenomena that often happens, especially as people get older and they lose their eyesight or little parts of their vision, is what's called Charles Bonnet syndrome. And actually James Thurber, the famous cartoonist, had it. He often drew fantastic figures in his cartoons and apparently actually saw them. So this is not that uncommon, that people will start to see things that appear in the kind of blind spots in vision, because our brains are very active and imaginative in trying to fill in those areas. And in fact,
I'm trying to bring is religion, mm-hmm. that people can fantasize heaven and hell and God and everything else because they were taught from an early age.
Yeah, and that's what I'm suggesting, is that we are constructing our experience of reality, and we're often filling in that reality with how we have been shaped as children to understand it. And for some people, that involves the supernatural.
Well, that leads to – thank you for your call, Tom. That leads to a question that comes up – used to come up quite often, doesn't come up quite so much anymore. That, for instance, the Harry Potter books. There were a whole bunch of parents who didn't want their children to read Harry Potter or see the movies because it was about witches and warlocks and spells and all these fake supernatural things, and they didn't want their kids to be indoctrinated into that. Maybe they had a point.
Well, I take a more ecumenical view, that not that these things are always wrong or bad or even false, but they're a part of the fabric of our interconnected subjectivity. So how we exist in a community, and we understand ourselves through the other people around us initially, our family, and then the larger communities that we enter through school and work and as we grow.
The last film in the series has a line in it that says, "Life is but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets its hour upon the stage and is heard no more." It's the Scottish tragedy. I think we can, well, although there's a theater in the building, so I'm not sure we can say M-A-C-B-E-T-H in this building. But I never thought of it as a ghost story, but life is but a walking shadow. All of life is a ghost story.
Right. It's a really interesting one. I don't write about it in my book, but we decided to put it in as the fifth film in our series, with Professor Andrew Hartley leading the discussion afterwards. He's our specialist in Shakespeare at UNC Charlotte Department of Theater, and he's actually recently created an audiobook and then now a published book. The audiobook was actually narrated by Alan Cumming. And so Professor Hartley, Andrew Hartley, co-authored this with David Hewson, and it's a novelization of Macbeth, so it fills in even more of the detail of the story.
The second part of that "life is but a walking shadow" line is, "It is a tale told by an idiot filled with sound and fury, signifying nothing." So how should we take that?
Well, and I was going to say, too, there's many different types of ghosts in Macbeth, of course, it's a story about Lord and Lady Macbeth and how they achieve power through villainy and murder, and yet how they're haunted themselves by what they have done. So it really kind of brings us back to what we were talking about earlier, how there are ghosts inside of us. Sure. And so the ghostly manifestations in that, initially through the witches, right, who tempt Macbeth, but then also Banquo, a friend of Macbeth's, whom he kills as someone who is a competitor, appears at a banquet in a chair there where Macbeth was going to sit down. And so that ghost, which only Macbeth sees, but then reveals how tormented he is inside, is one of the obvious manifestations. But the witches also show multiple ghosts of Banquo's progeny, his offspring, who are going to become kings. And then there's a dagger, a ghostly dagger that Macbeth sees, and, of course, the famous spots on Lady Macbeth's hand.
So when Lord Macbeth sees the empty chair and sees the ghost in the empty chair, is that where Clint Eastwood got the idea?
Maybe.
This, of course, is worth seeing, if only because Patrick Stewart is in it. All right, Matt.
It's actually a very interesting production, too, directed by Rupert Gould, because it updates the film, the play again, to the Stalinist era, and reminds us that this kind of totalitarian and everyone spying on one another and turning, betraying one another, even if you're friends, can happen close to our own time.
Yeah, Matt, I want to get a list of films from you that are not on this film series that you like as ghost stories. I was going to bring up The Sixth Sense because I really liked that film. I see dead people. I felt a kinship with that. But you don't like it, so...
No, I like it okay. I just think... the others is better. But yes, I do have other films to mention. We talked earlier about, you know, a lot of the ghost movies being made for profit. And I think one of the most interesting in that respect is 13 Ghosts from 1960. It's not a great film. It's a fun film. But what's interesting there is William Castle, the producer, director, showman, he created something. He had gimmicks for most of his movies. He created something for that one called Illusion O, that if you came into the theater, they gave you glasses, not unlike 3D glasses, with a red and a blue lens. And if you were too scared to see the ghost on screen, you'd look through one side and you wouldn't be able to see them. But if you were brave enough, you look through the other side and you could see them right there on the screen. And what it was a black and white movie, and the ghosts were tinted blue, so that if you look through the red one, obviously you could see the figure outline of the ghost, but if you looked at the blue one, it blended into the black and white background. And I just thought that was fascinating that he came up with this gimmick where you could actually choose whether to see the ghost on screen or not.
Yeah, how is it that we have friendly ghosts, like the Ghost of Mrs. Muir, 1947, which I think became a... Did it become a TV show? Yes, it did. And then 1937, we have Topper, which became a pretty big hit on television in a different incarnation with Leo G. Carroll as Topper, I believe. Yeah. And then we have movies like The Haunting and Poltergeist, in which these ghosts are really evil and do damage and are threatening. Why should ghosts ever be scary, since we create them in our mind? What does that say about us and about our neural traces?
Well, I would say that we're wrestling with ghosts all our lives. And we're haunted because the self is a ghost. And so we're never quite sure who we are and how others are viewing us. And who we are is very much dependent on how others see us. Mm. And so that can be friendly if we feel connected to people, or, you know, that can be something insidious and sinister if we feel that others might see us in a way we don't want to be seen.
Let's go to...
Because some movies have, like, what you would think initially is either a scary or friendly ghost, where they seem more complacent. There's this one movie called Carnival of Souls from 1962. I think that's one of the best ghost stories. It was made like for $30,000 by some businessman in Kansas who mainly made industrial films. And of course, like, nobody saw it at the time, but over the years it's become this cult classic. And in that one, there's this young woman, organist at a church, and she's haunted throughout the movie by these sightings of a pale-faced white man and with real ghostly appearance, and she sees other figures like that throughout the movie. And the whole movie, I mean, it's really creepy with the low budget atmosphere. You're just wondering, are they there to hurt her? Are they there to help her? And like many of these movies, it has a twist and a really good one at the end.
Are ghost films better when they're low budget? I'm just curious, because I've seen a lot of low budget horror films that seem better because they're so bad.
Well, in a way, I think that goes back to the theater tradition, you know, where you don't have as many special effects,
right,
but you can use the audience imagination. Mm-hmm. So the edge of the screen in a movie, in a way, functions like the stage edge or the recesses of a haunted house, if you feel your house is haunted, that you can project into those areas what would be more real as a ghost.
As long as we're talking about neural traces, let me bring Vicki and York into the conversation very quickly. Vicki, go ahead.
Oh, yes. How would you explain mediums that hear other people's departed ghosts or loved ones if it only comes from your own psyche?
Well, there's a long tradition going back even before the beginnings of theater of shamanistic ritual, where the shaman would be a traveler into another world, mm-hmm, the world of dreams or collective communal unconscious. And you either believe that can happen, or you can, you know, also research how the shaman was a kind of magician who maybe modern, some of these modern mediums are doing that as well. In other words, using a kind of partly therapeutic, partly trickster mechanisms to help people to experience what they want to perceive, or at least what's inside of them, as the ghosts of someone departed.
But if you've seen any of the medium, the New Jersey medium, where she says things that no one else could know, I mean, I don't know how you would explain that.
Yeah, well, the unexplained is not, you know, where science can help us in that sense, but it can help us to understand why this would be popular and how it can be represented then in film.
I can see the TV show, The Real Mediums of New Jersey. Thank you for your call, Vicki. Very quickly, because we're short on time, Khalid in Mooresville.
Hi.
Hi.
Do you know the movie Beloved? What did you think of that ghost story?
I'm glad you mentioned that. I had written that down to bring it up because it's a really interesting novel, of course, by Toni Morrison, and then the film by Jonathan Demme with Oprah Winfrey starring is quite a powerful film. It's about slavery, or actually the time right after slavery, and how the black people are haunted by people that they've lost and how they had been controlled and had lost their sense of selves in that slave period.
Yeah, I agree. It's a very strong film, and I've never understood why it was so panned all the way around.
I love that movie. I remember watching it the first time, and then like 3 hours later, after the movie was over, you know, when I left the movie, I was like, what did I just watch? It's so weird. And then the pieces started falling together later on, and I'm walking, you know, down the street going, oh, and that's why, and that's why.
And that's when you know you've seen a really good movie, when things like that happen for hours or even sometimes days after you've seen it. Thank you for your call.
When you're haunted in a good way.
Exactly right, when you're haunted in a good way. We have a couple email comments that I'll pass on to you, but we don't have time to get to them on the air because we are plumb out. Matt Brunson is entertainment editor of Creative Loafing and their movie critic. Thank you for being with us again, Matt. And Dr. Mark Pizzotto, professor of theater and film at UNC Charlotte, author of Ghosts of Theater and Cinema in the Brain, and the creative force behind Spirits Rise, a ghost film series at ImagineOn and UNCC Center City through November 17th.